The cherry blossoms have come and gone here in Washington. Rain clouds have dominated the skies for much of the past month. Afternoons have that hint of the stifling humidity that will come with summer. More tourists are wandering the National Mall, crowding the capital city's closely guarded shrines, monuments, and museums. Washingtonians accept the out-of-towners comfortably. Many residents first came to the city as tourists or job hunters themselves. Journalist Christopher Buckley was one. He moved to the District of Columbia from New York in 1981 to take a job writing speeches for then-Vice President George H.W. Bush. Buckley says his reaction to Washington surprised many of his New York friends.
I fell in love with it, actually. I really fell for the city. About a month after I moved here, I had parked my VW convertible on Capitol Hill, and everyone talked in those days about how terrible the crime was at Capitol Hill, and you have to lock everything up. And I just, this one night, didn't bother to put my top up. And I came back, and there was a red rose on the seat of the car. And I thought, cool. Since then, of course, my car has been broken into several times, but I'll hold on to that memory.
Christopher Buckley has accumulated many personal memories of Washington in the two decades he's lived here. Through the years, he's also become something of an authority on his adopted hometown. Buckley has written a new guidebook, Washington Schlepped Here, Walking in the Nation's Capital. He took us on a recent tour of some of his favorite places in the city. We met in Lafayette Square, just north of the White House.
We're sitting right now in what used to be an apple orchard before the White House was ever built. And when it became the White House grounds, this was actually the front lawn. But President Jefferson thought it was too much, it was too grand, that the White House should have more modest grounds. So he cut what's now Lafayette Square off, where the path, which he called Executive Way, which we now know as, of course, Pennsylvania Avenue.
In Lafayette Square in 1801, Thomas Jefferson threw a birthday party for America on the 4th of July.
He thought it should be loud. He thought it should be boisterous and noisy, sort of like our new republic. So there were events to sort of offend every modern sensibility. There were fireworks and cockfights and dogfights. The detail that I love was that the ladies of Cheshire, Massachusetts, sent a cheese to the president. It was a 1,200-pound cheese. And this was put in the foyer, I guess, of the White House, and it was a sort of, you know, everyone could come. And people attacked this 1,200-pound cheese with their fingers and bowie knives and everything, leaving probably, arguably, the worst mess in American history. But the next year, another town, not to be outdone, sent a 1,400-pound cheese. And this very something very American about that sort of cheese upsmanship.
One upsmanship remains important in Washington. Around back of the White House, beyond the ellipse, monuments to Jefferson and other immortals of the American Republic compete for prominence along the National Mall. Current residents of the White House can stand on the Truman Balcony, look out, and imagine themselves someday celebrated in stone. We've made it to the far western end of the National Mall, and behind us is the Washington Monument, and in front of us is the Lincoln Memorial. What does this monument say to you?
Well, it says, I think it's one of the most stirring monuments in Washington. I don't think you can walk up those steps and see this Daniel Chester French statue of Lincoln sitting there and read the inscription above him, which, if memory serves, says, "In this temple, as in the hearts of those for whom he saved the Union, the memory of Abraham Lincoln is enshrined forever." I think it's hard to regard those graven words without getting a lump in your throat.
The statue of Abraham Lincoln sitting on a marble throne, Buckley points out, contains a little-known message.
Daniel Chester French was a friend of Thomas Gallaudet, who was the son of the Gallaudet who started what we now know as Gallaudet College. It was an institute for the deaf. And President Lincoln had signed, had introduced the legislation chartering Gallaudet. And so as an homage to that, if you look closely at the Lincoln's hands and the statue in the Lincoln Memorial, you'll see that the left hand spells out the letter A in sign language, and the right hand spells out the letter L.
Buckley also says the Lincoln Memorial is testament to how long it can take the power brokers in Washington to make even the most obvious decisions.
President Lincoln was killed in 1865. Wouldn't you think that they would have succeeded at putting up a memorial to him before 1922?
Is that when it went up?
That's when it went up, finally. This was, we're in what was then a terrible swamp. In fact, the Speaker of the House, who was a colorful character named Joe Cannon, said in the 1920s, when it was proposed that this go up here, that he would be, quote, goddamned if he will see a memorial to Lincoln go up in that swamp.
Despite Cannon's objection to the location, the swamp became home to Lincoln's memorial. President Warren Harding dedicated the shrine 81 years ago this past week. Attending the ceremony were former President and then Supreme Court Chief Justice William Howard Taft and President Lincoln's only surviving son, Robert Todd Lincoln. The keynote address was given by the head of the Tuskegee Institute, Dr. Robert Moton.
He was not allowed to sit with the other dignitaries. He had to sit in the, quote, colored section. How's that for a memorial dedication to the memorial of the president who freed the slaves and brought about Emancipation Proclamation? That really monstrous bit of karma was, I think, nicely vitiated some years later in August of 1963 when possibly the greatest oration ever delivered in America was delivered by Martin Luther King from those steps when he stood there and said to a crowd of many hundreds of thousands, "I have a dream."
Mm.
I say maybe the greatest speech, because graven on the walls of the Lincoln Memorial are the two other speeches that I think contend with Martin Luther King's for honor of greatest speeches ever given in America. One, of course, being the Gettysburg Address, and the other being the second Lincoln inaugural, with its memorable lines, "With charity for all, with malice toward none." And here come the helicopters, this being modern Washington.
Helicopters on patrol in the skies above the memorials, the Capitol, and the White House are a part of everyday life in Washington during the war on terrorism now. Just as 140 years ago, when armed troops patrolled Washington streets during the Civil War.
We're right on the banks of the Potomac River. And just beyond the Potomac River was the home of Robert E. Lee, who was Mr. Lincoln's adversary. I mean, the South in 1861 began right here, right across that body of water.
Today, Memorial Bridge connects the capital city with the far banks of the Potomac, where Arlington National Cemetery now dominates the land once owned by the hero of the Confederacy.
We're standing on what was Robert E. Lee's driveway, right in front of his house. Well, several years into the Civil War, the Union general who was in charge of what we would now call graves registration, or as they called it then, burials, his name was Montgomery Meigs, and he hated Robert E. Lee, and he hated him for a very particular reason. His son, Meigs' son, had died in the Civil War, so he began planting the Union dead along Robert E. Lee's driveway, which is, if you think of it, an absolutely chilling, an act of revenge that's almost out of classical antiquity. It's literally sort of salting the earth. And you can see the tombstones there. They look almost like parking markers.
Yeah.
But there they are. And there, just there, was Mrs. Lee's rose garden, and Meg's planted in that rose garden the bones of 2,700 Union soldiers from various battles.
Tombstones dot the carpet of lawn which flows down from Lee's old mansion to the river, past the graves of thousands of American servicemen and women, career soldiers and draftees, generals, privates, and presidents. Beyond the Potomac stretches the District of Columbia, the Lincoln Memorial, the Washington Monument, and the Capitol Dome. The bustle of the nation's capital feels distant from the quiet of the burial ground, despite the occasional sound of gardeners and visitors to grave sites. High on this hill is the final resting place of Pierre Charles L'Enfant. A Frenchman, L'Enfant volunteered to fight in the Continental Army and served as artist extraordinary with General George Washington at Valley Forge.
Once the war was done, he put himself forward to Washington as the designer of this federal city. It wasn't going to be called Washington. Washington didn't want it to be called that. Anyway, he came up with this very beautiful plan for Washington, which is very much the Washington we have today, which is to say wide avenues, circles, and squares. It looks sort of like a cleverly thought-out spider web, if you will, but very European. And it all probably would have turned out well if poor L'Enfant hadn't been, well, the history books describe him as a temperamental character.
L'Enfant's personality won him many enemies. Finally, Washington had to fire him. And the master designer of the nation's capital finished his years in relative obscurity. L'Enfant died in 1825 and was buried in a pauper's grave in the town of Bladensburg on the outskirts of Washington. In 1909, L'Enfant was given a proper burial. His final journey began at the U.S. Capitol.
His coffin rested on the catafalque that supported the coffin of Lincoln. No other body had been accorded that privilege. And there was a 1 mile long procession from the Capitol, which you can see in the distance, all the way here, and all the great men and dignitaries of the day gathered around this spot where we stand. And one of them was the commissioner of Washington, a man named McFarland. And he said he in his remarks that he hoped someday there would be a statue of L'Enfant, but he said something very, very lovely. He said that the beauty of the city itself, increasing with the years, will always be the best remembrancer of his fame. And so it wasn't such a bad end after all for old L'Enfant.
Christopher Buckley, his book is called Washington Schlepped Here. And thank you so much for taking us on a, albeit brief, but a lovely tour of your Washington, D.C.
My pleasure. Thanks for allowing me to be a tourist in my hometown.
To see snapshots from our walking tour of Washington with Christopher Buckley and to learn about the curse of Lafayette Square, please visit our website at npr.org.